From the BBC in London, this is Brian Matthew presenting another in our series of profiles of top people from the rock scene. And with me in this program, ace guitarist Jeff Beck. Some sample sounds there from the guitar of Jeff Beck, featured on a Stevie Wonder composition, Superstition, from Beck, Bogart and Apogee.
Had you always wanted to be a musician?
Right from,
can you remember ever wanting to do anything else?
My mother insisted I took piano lessons, which I shunned straight away. Used to take the money for the piano lesson and run off and spend it on something else. But I didn't like keyboard instruments at all. I couldn't get along with them. Took up the violin and cello. Didn't like the idea of the bow. I wanted to touch the strings with my fingers. You know. Yeah.
What sort of age would you be then?
About 9 or 10.
Mm.
And then I went back onto piano for a while because I just didn't have anything else. We had a grand piano in the front room and I used to plonk around on it. And then I borrowed someone's guitar and that was it. The piano got the dust cover over it and got left in the corner.
Where was home, Jeff?
In Wellington, Surrey, mm-hmm. where I lived for about 20 years.
Now, when you started to play guitar, who were your idols at that time?
Les Paul. I think they used to use one of his tunes as a signature tune for one of the BBC programs, I can't remember.
Don't remember it myself.
How High the Moon it was. I remember hearing it every week anyway.
Yeah.
And it just was like, you know, impregnated in my brain, the sound of this slap back echo on the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And I just knew that I had to do, you know, be able to do that one day.
It was pretty revolutionary at its time.
Absolutely.
Wasn't it?
Still is now.
One thing that strikes me is that of the relatively few guitarists who've been in your kind of area, without particularly thinking of names, they all seem to have had relatively short careers and been either overtaken by disaster or they've opted out.
Yeah.
And yet you go on from band to band.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts about why that
Well, I never plan anything. It just seems to happen that way.
Mm-hmm.
I think the most LPs I've done with one group is two.
Yeah.
You know, and the group just seems to fold up somehow.
Does this mean that your musical ideas change particularly or you tire of working with some guys?
Yeah, the musical taste changes and... Mm. You know, I don't like to be surrounded with the same bunch of people for year in, year out.
Yeah. Do you think, without mentioning names, that this has been the hang-up for one or two other people, that they haven't changed?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You have, I should think, for the greater part of your career, been able to play with musicians you wanted to play with, haven't you?
Yes, yeah, luckily they've been available. You know,
And even in bands that you've fronted and so on, you've got guys that have... really made something. I don't remember the band before the Yardbirds. It was the Tridents, wasn't it?
Yeah.
When did that start?
Let me see. I joined the Yardbirds in 65, about a year before that, 64.
Mm-hmm. What was the sort of lineup on it?
It was just a regular sort of guitar, bass, drums, rhythm guitarist. Used to do all blues things, mostly.
Did you record at all?
We did one demo, and it was me making lots of vulgar noises on the guitar, and I thought, well, if nobody takes any notice of that, then... I think it probably would have done something. It would probably die a death or something, but people would have listened because it was so hideous.
But it never got released?
No.
Was there anybody...
Never got released, but I joined the Yardbirds. It was in the sort of pipeline to be released.
Was there anybody else in that band who's since gone on to other things?
No. Unfortunately, they were all good players.
Then who were the other musicians in the Yardbirds when you joined?
Keith Ralph was the vocalist, Chris Dreyer was on rhythm guitar, Paul Samuel Smith bass, and Jim McCarty on drums.
And then there was that remarkable period when there were two lead guitars.
A very short period, but very remarkable.
Yeah. But what brought that about?
Well, Sam, as he was nicknamed, Paul Samuel Smith, decided he wanted to get out of the group and go into producing, so I thought, well, that's all right. And I was worried because Sam had this incredible power in the group.
Yeah.
He was one of the first guys I ever saw play 4-string chords on a bass guitar.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole stage used to fold up underneath the impact. And I thought, well, there's only one chap I can think of who's competent, a really good guitar player and could make a competent bass player, and that was Jimmy Page.
Mm-hmm.
And we somehow worked him in the group after much wheeling and dealing. And it was great for a while. But then he wanted to get on the regular 6-string guitar.
Sure.
So we put Chris on bass. And the two of us just used to rip and roar all night long, you know, on guitar. It was really good.
Great, great wailing sounds, marvellous. Would you ever like to do that sort of thing now? I mean, you're in the restricted 3-man lineup.
Yeah, I would, you know. I mean, I still say that a 3-piece rock group is the best for the type of stuff we're playing, but I do have this underlying sort of desire to play different things with a bigger lineup.
Beck's Bolero, written by Jimmy Page and recorded by the 1967 Jeff Beck Group. Did you have any tuition at all on guitar? Were you entirely self-taught?
I had a friend who was taking lessons, and he said the only way to learn is to go and have lessons. And I went along to his teacher, and the teacher was so bad. I knew that I could probably do better than he was doing, you know, just given a couple of years on my own.
And it turned out to be right. If there was a youngster listening today, as there probably is, who feels that you were his idol and he'd like to be a guitarist, I mean, how would you recommend he should start? What would he get for an instrument?
That's impossible, is it really, to answer, because you have to have a certain amount of determination, and I don't know
what
it feels like to be back in those days. You know, they're gone now, those days of tramping around and trying hard, you know, all the time.
But, I mean, it doesn't really need a sort of tremendous expensive instrument to get started.
No, not at all. It's nice if you've got a leg up the ladder, as it were, you know, with a nice instrument, but it can work the other way around. If you get a bad one, then it's all the better when you get a good guitar. Yeah.
Did you start electric?
No, I built one out of a piece of old junk lying around, you know, some wood. And
so you did start to learn on acoustic guitar, is what I'm
hearing. Yes.
Do you think that's a good idea?
Yes. It teaches you to learn how to attack the instrument without getting hung up with any technical sort of, you know, pickups and wiring and stuff like that, and amplifiers. I mean, the kid nowadays learning to play would probably won't want to listen to that, but it's best to start off on acoustic, I would say.
Right. How necessary to have a working knowledge of music?
I didn't have any at all, really. None that I could use. I mean, I know the notes on the piano and all the stuff, but I couldn't read a piece of music and play it. Even now, it's all from my head.
Yeah. You started then, when you started to be a musician, you had pretty cheap equipment yourself, I imagine. Does this hang up at all? Or?
It had its advantages. I didn't invent feedback because it was already there, but I discovered it. And put it to use in the R&B, which has never been done up to that time anyway.
That's something I'd like to take you up on in just a moment. Maybe we could have another track of music before we do that. And a now familiar voice in that Jeff Beck version of Jailhouse Rock, none other than Rod Stewart, of course.
Well, I said we'd talk about feedback, and can you explain for idiots like me exactly what this is?
Well, from a guitar, I mean, there's feedback of all sorts of microphone. Probably the most common is the microphone, where it seems to me that the sound comes out of the speakers and feeds back into the microphone, for example, and causes a whistle or a hum to build up to sort of really bad proportions until it's painful to listen to.
How did you find you could use this practically?
Well, with a string of a guitar, what was happening, I found, was the cabinet. If by resting the guitar against the cabinet, the vibration of the note was continued through the speaker, and it formed an endless circle of noise. And you could, with a little bit of practice, learn how to bend the note, maintaining the right pitch, you know, and play a tune in feedback.
So your music was once described as you were in fact playing the amplifier as opposed to playing the guitar.
Yeah, I used to use the noises the amp made, you know, to play with.
And so did Pete Townsend, among others.
Yeah, well, he was a lot more violent, you know, he used to just crash the hell out of the guitar and break it up and all that.
But using the same basic principle.
Yeah.
Do you still do this at all?
Oh yes, when the mood takes me, but I don't play on it too much because I've done it for so long.
You were doing it then because it was a new use.
I just wanted to draw attention to the group and the way I played, and that was a good way of doing it.
Do you think there are new unexplored uses on the guitar that
every time I come to the end of what I think is, you know, the possibilities on the guitar, someone else comes up with something.
Yeah.
Like the synthesizers for the guitar now, which are in the early stages, but they're pretty interesting.
Really?
A thing like a scrambler as well, which can make the guitar split the signal from the strings, and you're getting like three or four notes at once from one string.
Wow.
But it's a bit mind-boggling because it's not true music, it's just the machine is playing you.
Join me, Brian Matthew, for more great sounds from Jeff Beck in part two of our profile, produced for the BBC by Dave Tate and Pete Dauncey.
From the BBC in London, this is Brian Matthew with part two of A Profile of Jeff Beck. More words, more music, more great sounds from one of the top rock guitarists in the world today. The fabulous guitar of Jeff Beck there with Tim Bogert and Carmine Apogee. Stay tuned for more later in the show. Meanwhile, a few words with Jeff, who's right here with me in our London studio.
Done yourself over the years in America, haven't you?
Yeah, touring with different groups and things.
Do you enjoy playing there particularly?
Oh, I enjoy playing. That's the only thing I do enjoy, though.
Yeah.
Except for scouting around for antique cars and things. But, you know, it's just a tedious business. You know, I think it's great for a group that's just broken out somewhere in England, wants to get abroad and see America. It's fantastic, sort of like a free holiday, if you like a travel, like all around the country for nothing, as it were. But I've seen too much of the place.
When you go on stage there, or indeed in this country, with the reputation which you've gained, do you find that this is, in some instances, perhaps an obstacle to that particular performance, that you're expected to do certain things?
Oh, yes. I mean, especially if you're not feeling too good.
Mm.
You know, I mean, obviously you can't... I'm not that good that I can pull it out of the bag every night. And it means that some audience somewhere is going to have to get a lesser performance than, say, the previous night.
Yeah.
Which can't be avoided, you know. I mean, if you've just had a big fist fight in the dressing room, yeah, I can't just switch off and you know, come out with glistening white teeth and smile and all that. People are going to get an interpretation of my feelings at that time on the guitar.
Yeah. In various reviews I've read, you've been described frequently as looking rather moody on stage and in performance. Would that have been on occasions like that?
Yeah, I probably appear to look moody, but it's probably because I'm frightened. I don't like facing large crowds. I hate all that.
And yet you enjoy playing.
Oh, afterwards. I mean, the reward is afterwards. If it goes well,
yeah,
then it's all been worthwhile kind of thing. But walking on stage is the worst moment to me. I hate it.
Walking off after one that you know has gone well.
Oh, you can't tell anybody what that feels like.
You can't tell us what it feels like, but what do you do after a concert that's really got off?
It depends where I am. If I'm in England, I'll probably just go out and get thoroughly plastered. more plastered, I should say.
I see.
If I'm in America, you know, there's always something to do, you know, sort of hanging out at someone's house or something equally psychedelic. But you know, what does one do on the road? You know, you've got to make your own entertainment most of the time.
Yeah.
Don't mean throwing televisions out of the window.
Right. Are you going to tour less or more in the foreseeable future?
Sorry?
Are you going to tour more or less?
I'm trying to cover really good markets that I've got going for me out there, like Los Angeles, New York. Most of the big cities we do fairly well as a group. And I think that it's unnecessary to tour these small provinces and, you know, lesser-known towns, unless there's a big festival somewhere in the summer. I mean, you know, you can play in unheard-of towns and you get, like, 50,000 people rolling up.
Yeah.
That's all right, but during the winter, or up to June, I should say, I'd like to just play a two-week tour of big towns.
Recorded in 71 for the Rough and Ready album, one of Jeff Beck's own compositions, Train, Train, Train.
Of the bands in which you've worked, disregarding for the moment the present scene, which do you think gave you the most pleasure from a musical point of view?
Well, there were times in the Yardbirds and times in the Rod Stewart group that both had the magic, you know, for me. And it's hard to decide which one was best. I suppose the Yardbirds, because my eyes were open to the music scene through that group.
Mm-hmm.
And I really started to play seriously. And it's like the milestone in my life,
right,
that group.
The band you mentioned with Rod was the one which for you followed the Yardbirds, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right.
Now then there was another band somewhere along the way that I remember got slagged pretty heavily.
Yeah, that was Jeff Beck Group Number 2.
Yeah.
With Bobby Tench, Max Milton, Clive Chamon, and Cozy Powell on drums. Mm.
Well, there were some great musicians in there. What went wrong, do you think?
What went wrong? I don't really know. I just think that the journalists that were reviewing the shows didn't have any imagination, or just that we disappointed them in some way. I suppose if we'd stayed together, we may have changed their minds, but I didn't give it long enough.
Do you think the jazz elements were perhaps tending to emerge at the expense of the rock?
Yeah, I believe that's right. Max Middleton's very heavily into jazz. And it was like a breath of spring to hear somebody play a nice chord, you know, instead of just a major or a minor just a seventh chord. He used to play some beautiful chords and make me play in a different way, so therefore I thought he was valid. But we obviously didn't come off to people's expectations.
So it didn't last too long. What do you think about the current position of, or at least the current sort of rating of British rock bands generally? Is it good or bad?
Well, the worst groups are getting worse, and the good groups are getting incredibly good. I suppose the Who is a prime example, because they've been around right from ever since I can remember, and they're just getting bigger and bigger all the time.
Did you enjoy the, what should we call it, the relatively heavy period that we went through for a while, with the sort of, it's awful because one puts these in brackets tags on, you know, the underground bit, I mean. Did you enjoy that?
No, not too much, no. I felt that the ultimate heavy band was Hendrix at one time. I mean, you could not get any heavier.
True. All right, well, I want to talk about the present setup and maybe where we're going after that, and we've not got a lot of time left.
And that was a sample of the latest Jeff Beck group, a number called Black Cat Moan.
All right, well, now, the present band, as I've said, Beck Bogart's Apiece?
Apiece, really, but he calls it himself Apiece.
Apiece, right. They were originally with which band? With
Vanilla Fudge,
wasn't it? Is that where you met up with them?
Yeah. They rang me up one day when I was in New York and said, would I stand in for their guitarist on a session? And I thought, yeah, that would be nice, going on a Vanilla Fudge album. I got around there and there was a couple of Coca-Cola representatives there, and it was apparently for a jingle for Coke. And I did it anyway, I got $300, I was pleased. And it made me realise that there were really fine players around the New York area. And I always kept them in the back of my mind that one day I'd like to play with them.
And it's happened, it's taken a long time, but that was due to other things, wasn't it?
Well, legal problems and
car crashes and
run-of-the-mill, you know, stuff.
But you would call it now a sort of regularly constituted band, and you play a lot. How much work have you done together?
Let's see, we've done one album and about 10 tours all over the place, all over the world, Japan. We're very big in Japan, funnily enough. I can't understand why, when there's so many other huge groups around.
Is it not in any sense a problem? I mean, you live in the Kent countryside, they live in the States.
Yeah.
You must be the only commuting trio in the business, I should think.
Yeah, McLaughlin was, they were an Anglo-American band, I suppose. It's great because although you don't get to rehearse when you really feel like rehearsing, unless you sort of all agree to meet in a certain place, which doesn't happen, it's got its advantages and disadvantages, them living over there. I mean, I never get fed up with them hanging around and calling up, and, you know, it's like a new band every time they come over, kind of thing.
And when you come to record, does this mean that it all starts from scratch the moment you get in the studio?
Yes, well, you see, when we're on the road, you have about 23 hours of the day to do nothing. and we often sort of come up with a few nice riffs and things, put them on a cassette tape and just enlarge on them as the time goes by on the tour. So we roll two things into one, you know, the tour and rehearsing. And it's good because after a show you want to relax, and sometimes the way to relax is to play.
But you keep what you do, in effect, on
tape.
You're not going in, at least with no material, to record.
Oh, no, that's absolutely fatal. And I was listening to Cobham on the TV the other day, and he said the same thing. If there's an unlimited studio time available, you just dry up after a while, and you just get paranoid and want to go home. And I think it's good to go in with stuff absolutely ready to record and get in and out as quickly as possible.
Another item from the album, Beck, Bogart and Apiece, You Never Care.
And to do straight takes, or do you do a lot of overdubbing?
They want me really to play the way I play on stage in the studio, which is impossible because I'm an animal on stage. It's hard to become an animal in a studio when no one's watching, you know? So I tend to want to just play strong rhythm passages, chords, and just keep the thing together, overdub the solo, and then overdub the vocals.
But that is it. I mean, you don't want to go into involve multi-tracking.
No way.
And what about augmenting for recording? Would you ever consider that?
Piano, I love the piano. All sorts of keyboard instruments. I don't like the Hammond organ, really, very much, except the way Booker T plays. But I'd like to play with Ian Hammond one day, if it's all right with him.
Great.
You know, I just love electric pianos, Fender pianos, clavinet, grand piano, all that sort of stuff. but only, you know, to sort of support a particular piece of music, not to feature too much.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, let's have another piece of music now. Can you tell us perhaps some of the things that you're going to be doing in the foreseeable future, Jeff?
Well, we've got little snippets of tours. Thing. We've got a 4 or 5 day stint in Germany, followed by a 4 day or 5 day stint in Italy,
mm-hmm.
which is going to blow my mind. I know, because I've never played in Italy with a 3 piece like I've got now.
Mm.
Then we're off to Australia, Japan, and America.
There's a lot of work lying there.
Yeah.
Do the other two boys tend to work in any other area apart from with you?
They do more outside the BBA
mm-hmm.
Thing than I do. Largely because in New York there's loads of musicians. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. They bring back little tapes of jams they've done. It's really funny. They're playing with sort of wedding bands sometimes, you know, that play.
Available chronic. For weddings.
Yeah,
like it.
It's great. You know, just keeps them in trim.
Yeah. And you have, from time to time, as you've already told us in the programme, appeared on other people's records. I mean, Stevie
yeah.
for one.
Yeah.
Likely to do that, any more of that, do you think?
Well, I don't sort of have any immediate desire to, but if any offers come in that appeal to me, I don't mind doing, you know. So, I mean, with Stevie, I don't see how. I think that's one of my biggest achievements, getting on record with him.
There has been, though, in recent years, rather more of this, hasn't there, with people helping out their
yeah.
mates on
oh, record. It's great, you know, as far as yeah. I'm concerned, there's not enough of it, really.
In the, I suppose, small amount of time that you have to spend at home, do you devote most of your time to music or other pursuits?
I should say yes, but it would be a total lie. I spend all the time grovelling around under cars, getting thoroughly greased up and thoroughly drunk in the evenings, but I love it.
You must have someone to look after those 13 acres or whatever it was.
Yes, yes, yeah. I'm with a young lady at the moment who is in love with cats and... that's the way it's going to be.
Yeah. I mean, you don't go around with a shovel and a pickaxe and...
Good God, leave off.
All right, I'll leave off. BBA getting it together on Living Alone. This is Brian Matthews signing off, and I sincerely hope you've enjoyed hearing this portrait in words and music of Jeff Beck. The Jeff Beck profile came to you from the BBC in London and was produced by Dave Tate and Pete Dornsey.